1112. Stay safe and healthy. We are you.
Listener support and volunteer power are the foundation of community radio. To donate or volunteer at WERU, please call 469-6600 or email at info@weru.org or pledge online at weru.org. Thank you.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, debts, incomes, our own, those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to begin today's show with two stories, short stories, that I think epitomize what we've come to think of as the legacy of this strange year just past, 2021. I begin with an experience my wife and I had on December 29th, a Wednesday. We arrived 2 or 3 hours after our local bank, where we have our bank account, TD Bank, in case you're wondering. And we discovered that even though it was several hours after the normal opening as written on the door, they were closed. We knew that because there was a sign that said they were closed. No explanation. No telling us when or where or how they would reopen, which meant we could not access our money, which meant we could not access our safe deposit boxes where we keep our passports and things like that. Had we been making a trip or planning to go to the airport to go on a trip, we would have lost everything in the terms of that trip, the money we spent on it. Unconscionable behavior, reminding me of those famous pictures back in the Great Depression when banks closed their doors and everybody who had a deposit was told you don't have a deposit or you can't get to one and we'll never know whether you'll see your money again. That's a sign of system breakdown. And there's no excuse for it. We're into the third year of this pandemic. Everybody who knows anything knows that you may lose people who get sick or who get unable to come to work because other people are sick. So you have fallback people, people that are trained that you can call. Yeah, you have to pay them, and that might cost you a little extra. And there is the explanation for why our bank couldn't function. When a system like this works, when they risk all their clients because they're too cheap to have a few backup people to solve problems like this, you know that normal business is no longer with us. We are in abnormal business times. And here's the other story. Back on the 30th of December, I was invited, and I was glad to do this, to give a talk to a rally organized by students at Columbia University in New York City who were conducting a strike, 3,000 students against one of the richest Ivy League universities in the United States, which had apparently been doing one nasty move after another to undercut the unionization effort, to undercut the union's drive for decent pay, decent working conditions, and all the rest. Well, I am happy to tell you that after that rally, the university, I think, saw, as I certainly did, listening to the other student speakers, that they were up against a very solid, very well-prepared, very smart group of young people running this strike and understanding their enemy. I was impressed by the friends who came from Brown and Harvard universities who have already gone through these kinds of strikes to help them along. This is a young population that understands the capitalist system and what it's like as it declines, and they're not going to be required to take the hard, difficult decisions that the university would like to impose on them. On the 7th of January, the union and the university agreed to a tentative contract in which a union gets several of the major goals they set. Successful strike, young people. That's as much a legacy of 2021 as the absurd dysfunction of the TD Bank and others like it. All right, let's turn now to our normal regular set of updates. I begin with the town of Laredo, Texas. It's a small city on the Mexican border in South Texas, population about 250,000, so not a tiny city, a sizable city. But it is what economists have come to call a food desert. What does that mean? It means it's very, very hard in many parts of Laredo, Texas, to be able in a reasonable amount of time, in a short distance, to get healthy, good food, fresh meat, produce, fruits, vegetables, let alone the organic stuff. It's very hard. You're left with going to convenience stores where everything is in a bag or everything is in a box or everything is loaded with salt and fat and preservatives and all the rest. And why is that? Well, there's a simple answer. You see, it's not profitable in places like this where large populations of people who don't have a lot of money live. So it's not profitable for the supermarkets to come in. So they don't. And it's left to the convenience stores. That's all it is. It's capitalism's profit drive screws these people out of access to fresh, healthy food. That's the sad story. But I didn't pick it out to tell you that story. You probably knew that. I picked it out because in Laredo, a population exists that is doing something about it. They've come together to create worker co-ops. Yeah, co-ops that are going to serve the people that don't need to make a big fat profit the way the corporate giants do and are therefore prepared to get together, pool their efforts, pool their labor, make the prices a little cheaper, and do something about the food desert that is capitalism's sad contribution to Laredo, Texas. I want to also turn next to more results from what is called the World Inequality Report that we now get every year, usually around December of the year, and we have one for December 2021 that I've mentioned before. A group of economists, mostly based at the University of California in Berkeley, together with colleagues around the world, produced this report on who has it and who doesn't in the way of wealth and income. And I want to list again for you some of the major findings. By the way, you can just Google World Inequality Report and get much more data beyond what I am summarizing here. Under 3,000 billionaires exist in the world. Their wealth, collectively, add them up, these 3,000 folks, their wealth over the last 2 years of the pandemic grew by $3.6 trillion. Okay, let me be clear. The richest people on this planet, 3,000 of them, saw their wealth increase by $3.63 trillion. At the other end of the scale, 100 million more people were pushed into extreme poverty over these last 2 years. So that the number of people in extreme poverty, that's poverty, that's the worst you can be, according to this report, on the world as a whole, 711 million. So we added 100 million people while we made the richest billionaires richer still. And I say we, I'm being polite. Capitalism is the system that does that. And that's what we need to understand. The richest 10% of the world's people, because we have a world that's governed by that capitalist economic system, one way or another. 10% of the global population owns 76% of all wealth. The top 10% own more than three quarters of all the wealth. At the other end, the bottom 50%, that's 3.5 billion people, half the people of this world at the bottom. The bottom half together, they own, ready, 2%. There is no ethics, no morality that can defend that or justify it, even though you'll see quite a few hucksters devoting themselves to trying. And when it comes to income, it's not much different. Top 10% get 52% of all the income, and the bottom 50%, they get 8% of all the income. This is so horrific that we've seen recently, and I've mentioned it on this program, an effort to kind of get your attention away from the horror I just described to you by saying, well, we should credit capitalism because of over the last three centuries, conditions for people have improved. We do live longer, and we do have, in other words, don't look at the reality we live in, feel better because it could have been worse. And isn't capitalism good because it did it? I hate this. I hate it because it distracts us from the conditions now. It's an attempt to distract us from the immorality of the economic system called capitalism that generates these results. But most importantly, it's wrong. You know why we live longer? You know why we have some of the benefits that have developed over the last 3.5 centuries? It's not because of capitalism. It's despite capitalism. Every advance, whether it was public education, whether it was subsidized housing, whether it was improved health care, has been fought for by the mass of people against the opposition of capitalists. They want us to credit their system for what they tried to prevent and often did delay it. Look, every Western European country has a national health service guaranteeing everybody health insurance. We don't even have that yet. And guess who's opposing it? The mass of people? The labor movement? Uh-uh. The businesses, the corporate businesses that run the hospitals, the drug companies, and all the rest. We know who pushes for the advance. Don't be fooled. Capitalism produced the awful results of inequality we see today, and it fought all the gains that we have enjoyed over the last 300 years. And that's why it's appropriate to criticize capitalism. We have altogether too little of it in this country. What time remains, I'm going to use for the last update. The National Defense Appropriation Act. That's how the Congress each year decides on the military budget. And true enough, in December, President Biden signed the new NDAA. And I want to talk to you about it. First of all, Mr. Biden thereby gave $768 billion to the U.S. military. Here are some, just some, of the interesting aspects you probably haven't heard about or thought about, but I think you will be interested by. This is $25 billion more than President Biden requested. He requested an increase of the military budget at a time, by the way, when there's not enough money to keep us healthy, right? Because we're suffering COVID in a way other countries aren't. But he increased the budget, but the Congress increased it more. And I want you to be clear why. Because the congressmen and women are competing for the military to spend money in their districts to hire their workers so they can claim they were there to do that for their local people. They suck up to the military. And if the president increases it, they're going to outdo each other to increase it more. These are the same people who refuse to pay for the Build Back Better that has been cut to shreds across the entire 2021. No money for those, but the money for the military, throw it at them. Here's even more interesting. The total increase Biden did, plus the Congress, came to 5%. But the increase in the pay to the military, what is paid to the Marine, to the Navy personnel, the Army, and the Air Force, 2.7%. Friends, the military gets 2.7%. The general price increase in America, 7.5% now. They're not even allowing our troops to keep up. Meanwhile, if the average is 5 and the money given to the soldier is only 2.7, it means the money given to the corporations is around 7, 8, or 9%, because the average is 5. He gave the money to the businesses, just not to the people. Amazing. We've come to the end of the first part of today's show, and as always, I want to thank all of you whose support makes this show and others we produce possible. To learn more about the different ways you can support Democracy at Work and this program, Economic Update, please go to patreon.com/economicupdate or visit our website, democracyatwork.info. I also want to remind you of our recently released hardcover edition of Understanding Marxism that is available now, again, democracyatwork.info/books. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with a special guest, Tess Fraud Wolf. Welcome, friends, to the second half of today's Economic Update. It is with great pleasure that I bring to our microphones and to our cameras someone who's been on this program in the past, but who has something particularly important, I think, to bring to us today. She is Tess Fraud Wolf. She has practiced relational psychology or psychotherapy, excuse me, in New York City for over the last decade. She works with individuals and couples and has trained in both hypnotherapy and art therapy. Tess Fraud Wolf specializes in gender issues and offers an approach that incorporates various themes from an assortment of therapeutic modalities. Welcome, Tess. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, I've been talking with you, and that's why we decided to have this program, because you have some strong opinions, which I found not only very enlightening for me, but something I thought a very large audience would want to understand. And let me begin by asking you the question this way. Your argument, your belief, is that emotions and feelings are a key part of politics in the U.S. today, maybe more than ever. And they need to be better understood and valued because of the role they play. Could you explain that thought a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we're becoming more and more aware of our feelings as a society, especially in America. I think it's one of the positive things we can grab at, is that I grew up in the 80s, and it was sort of dawning that the issue of talking about feelings in the open without ridiculing that as trivial or ridiculous dawned kind of in the 80s. There was sort of a pop psychological awareness that hadn't been before. And that unfolded and expanded. And I think as a person who has studied a lot of psychology, I learned that feelings predicate thoughts, that everybody has feelings in every language, that babies cry before they know any word of any language. Feelings are universal, and they're the gut reactivity that we speak to often. I think that speaking to people's feelings is a very effective and powerful way to reach them, from various forms of art, which tap into that, to politicians, I think, some of whom seem to have discovered this and weaponized it, some of whom seem to have discovered this and utilized it progressively.
Okay, that's where I want to go with this. You and I have discussed this.
Yeah.
Am I right to say that it's your view that the Trump phenomena of the last 4 or 5 years that we've all been living through is an example of a politician who has made more use of emotion and feeling in the political way he proceeds and the people around him proceed, particularly as compared with the establishment Democrats like Pelosi and Schumer and Clinton? Could you, is that right? Have I got that right? And if so, could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I also think it predicated Trump. I don't think Trump's done anything very original, like most of his life, if not all of his life. I think he's a symptom of something that already began. I think Fox News harnessed tapping into people's rage, under which, you know, lay, I think, feelings of profound helplessness that do not get named often enough. Because rage is often a reaction to helplessness. First, we experience the feeling of helplessness. Then we become sometimes enraged by injustice, by assault or injury on our sense of dignity. And I think people are very, very angry in America right now, and they have been for a while. And a far right group has seized this anger, understanding that scapegoating, racism, xenophobia of all kinds is hyper-sellable when people are furious and feeling helpless.
So somehow the right has been able to connect its issues, its political agenda, to this anger that people feel.
Yeah, I think they've harnessed it. I think your point about the establishment Democrats is excellent. And at this sort of poker-faced, neutral delivery, you know, affects of gentility is boring, doesn't snag a soundbite. And I think more importantly, it doesn't speak to people's emotionalism, to how angry they are, how hurt they are, how helpless, how frustrated. You know, and it's not always, we're talking about some of the, you know, more destructive emotions, potentially some of the darker emotions, but they can be very valuable and constructive at the same time. But also feelings of joy, feelings of bliss, feelings of boredom, contempt. These are all feelings, and they're really important to which to speak. If you drone on and on like an automaton, like, you know, establishment Democrats and former establishment Republicans, like Bush, who Trump openly mocked for being boring, right? In this way that they do, it's, you know, aggressively boring.
Tell me, do you think that Bernie's campaign, and maybe also AOC and the other sort of younger versions, have they learned something? Are they doing it differently? How would you assess their relationship to what you've been talking about?
I would regard them as some of the more positively channeled emotional reachers. I do think that's exactly right. I think Bernie speaks to people's helplessness and rage, righteous rage at that. I think AOC and the squad as well, after the January 6th insurrection, counts on their lives and terror and fear, the squad, the four women then of AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley, they were very emotional about it. Like, some of them wept. They held hearings. They talked about fearing for their lives, feeling hunted, the trauma. And they were really open about it. It was very powerful. A therapist friend of mine said, I've never seen anything like this. This is real life. I mean, these people aren't posing for once. These people aren't sitting performatively dressed as though they're going to a ball or something. They're actually crying. They're sharing themselves. It was extraordinarily inviting to people, beguiling and very engaging.
So you would think that, if I'm hearing you right, that part of the appeal that Bernie, AOC, and the others have had is because of this willingness to be direct and engage feelings.
Not only part of it, but I think a huge part of it. Huge. As big as their progressive stances. Bernie is the famous picture of a moment over a year ago during Biden's inauguration with Bernie and the mittens, right? It became iconic and sweatshirts were sold and everybody loves it. And it's because he looked grumpy, which is an emotion, by the way. He looked contemptuous. He looked like he was really over it with the establishment Democrats flitting around dressed to the nines as though they were in the Oscars, which I think is bizarre, inappropriate, and can be looked at as kind of grotesquely ostentatious. And then Bernie sat there. He doesn't really give a crap. He's wearing whatever. He doesn't care about his hair. He has mittens some teacher sent him. He looks like, ugh. And everybody loved it because it was real. It was like watching the squad cry about their insurrection trauma. It was real. And people can tell often the difference. Of course, they can be duped, and they are sometimes. But I do think the human capacity has a faculty for truth that can be reached.
Am I going too far to imagine that the implication of what you're saying is that if the Democrats, even the establishment ones, but also even more perhaps the Biden AOC, I'm sorry, the Bernie AOC, if they take your message to heart, they could have a very different political impact on this country than they have had to date?
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. The vacancy of Pelosi and company's delivery is exhaustively boring, disenchanting, invites disengagement. And I think if the left can realize that they need to speak to people's feelings and they need to be feeling people themselves, not cardboard cutouts. People don't want policy wonks like Hillary Clinton. They're bored. Some of that is because we have different stages of addiction to technology and attention span compromises are many, but a lot of it is just a human experience that we have been drawn for years and years to emotion through forms of art and engagement, and that we are at base emotional creatures before we're thinking creatures.
And that politics has become something of a specialty for these quote unquote policy wonks. And since so little really changes in our lives, the sense of the irrelevance of conventional politics, I think, has settled in and become part of this culture that we're living in. Let me push you a little bit and say, could you come up with an example, one or two, about how something being argued could be argued more effectively if it engaged our feelings.
Absolutely. I think instead of drowning a lot of the political discourse in bureaucratic red tape measures, I think we need to speak to the direct effect things will have on people, to the direct effect things have had on people. If we use these words that we often shun, and certainly in the news, I hear them almost never. Words like lonely. People are desperately lonely since the pandemic. We want to use words like pandemic fatigue. Okay, fatigue is a physiological sensation mostly. It's tired. You're tired. Really what we're talking about is a feeling of defeat. That's an emotional experience, feeling defeated, feeling deflated, enervated, drained. We can all relate, especially through COVID and after the past few years. But I think if we go for that, if we look to speak to our emotions and the others, we can create bridges and interest where there is right now lack.
Huh. Tell me, why do you think that the American left, and being very broad here, everything from the Democratic Party on over to socialists and everybody else on the left, why has the left been less adept, less aware, less clued in to the what you're telling us than the right, or at least the Trump right? How do we account for that?
I mean, I think some of it had to do with where the Democrats gathered, tended to be in, you know, certain areas of the country that are associated with academic tendencies that have a cluster of schools. New England, urban places, have more diversity, have more educational possibility, often have more universities and colleges there. And I think there was this academic attachment to deliverance. There was this notion that if one was smart enough, with quotes around the word smart, since that's so broadly defined so many different ways, one could be convincing. And one wanted to be convincing because they wanted to share their political views. And I think there was a lot of mistake there, that intelligence is much broader and deeper than academically or intellectually related.
You know, you remind me of the very large number of times that I've encountered over the last 5 or 10 years, people, particularly from smaller states or rural areas or smaller cities, being very clear when they spoke to me that folks in California and New York and so on look down at them, feeling that they are being condescended to, not engaged with. So I think that, you know, I think that's more evidence for what you're basically saying, a sense of being excluded and devalued, almost one could say.
Absolutely. And again, I think we need to open up our notion of intelligence. It's, again, much wider and much deeper than about some school, some pedigree, the capacity to, you know, complete a subject within school, you know, exemplarily. That's great if you succeed there, but there's trillions different kinds of intelligence, and we need to respect that.
We have only a few seconds left. Any final appeal, given what you've told us, what you would like to see more political, particularly those on the left, do with what you've had to understand?
Yeah, I want us to be able to talk about feelings, our own and other people's, in abject terms, open, interested, instead of this idea that feelings are dismissible and possibly because they have a feminine vibe, because we've decided that women are the feeling havers in sort of stultified gender role land. I think if we start talking about all of our feelings as though we all have them, since we do, and try to shirk the notion that they are trivial or they will make us be taken seriously less often, that we can start a movement quietly and profoundly.
Well, thank you very, very much. I think this is exactly the kind of bringing of psychology into our understandings of the economy and politics. So my thanks to you and my appreciation for the work that you do.
Thank you.
And to all of you listening, I hope you have gained the kind of insights that led us to bring Tess Fraud Wolf before us today. And as usual, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Tune in to The Coffee House every Saturday and Sunday morning, where you can start your day with unique blends of folk music brought to you by a different host each week. On Saturdays, listen to Matt Heather, Steve, or Chuck. On Sundays, it's Sarah, Jane, Mary, Ned, or Rosa. We each bring to you our own mix of traditional and contemporary folk, bluegrass, country, Americana, and Celtic music, both old and new. That's the Saturday and Sunday Morning Coffee House from 7 to 10, only on WERU-FM, 89.9 in Blue Hill, and streaming all over the planet at weru.org.
Support for WERU comes from our generous listeners. Thank you.
Today on Wings, Sarah Schulman speaks about her nonfiction book titled Conflict Is Not Abuse.
So this book begins with something that so many things in our time begin with, a quote from James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sarah Schulman has won awards and fellowships. She's had a dozen novels published and several plays and screenplays produced. She's a distinguished professor at the City University of New York, and some of her nonfiction books are published by major university presses. But the book she speaks about in this program was published by a small press in Vancouver, Canada, Arsenal Pulp Press.
Nobody would publish this book in the States. And we've sold, I think, almost 10,000 copies in a year. It's in its fifth edition.
The book is titled Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. In November 2017, Schulman read from the book and talked with the audience in Vancouver for about an hour. Here are excerpts from that event.
No one can negotiate without being heard. Shunning, therefore, is designed to maintain a unilateral position of unmovable superiority by asserting one's status as abused and the implied consequential right to punish without terms. You have someone like Donald Trump who every single day tells us how abused he is, what a victim he is, and how it's a witch hunt, and it's so sad. Usually someone's telling the truth about him and his supremacy, and that's what he's referring to as an attack or abuse. At the same time, he's taking problems that are being experienced by the white working class in America who've had their jobs globalized by the white 1%, and he manipulates their anxieties and projects it onto immigrants, Muslims, and in last week, Haitians. As I began this book during the summer of 2014, we watched white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York, murder two unarmed black men, Michael Brown and Eric Garner. We watched a rich and powerful professional football player, Ray Rice, beat his wife, Janae, unconscious in an elevator. We watched the Israeli government mass murder over 2,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza. It quickly became apparent that the methods we've developed collectively to date to understand these kinds of actions in order to avoid them are not adequate. Now, as a novelist, in order to create characters that have integrity, I apply the principle that people do things for reasons. Even if they are not aware of those reasons, or even if they cannot accept that their actions are motivated instead of neutral and objective. Using this principle to examine those events, I have to ask myself what the white police officers, the wealthy football player, and the militarized nation state think is happening that produces and justifies their brutal actions. As video and witness accounts attest, neither Michael Brown nor Eric Garner did anything that justified the way they were treated by the police. Eric Garner sold loose cigarettes and Michael Brown walked down the street. Both men tried to offer the police alternatives to cruelty. Eric Garner informed the police of the consequences of their actions on him, when he told them 11 times while in an illegal chokehold, "I can't breathe." Michael Brown raised his hands in a sign of surrender and said, "Don't shoot." But something occurred within the minds, impulses, and group identities of the white police officers, and there they saw threat gross enough to justify murder. We know from security camera footage taken in a casino lobby and elevator that Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice and his wife were having a quarrel. As much as we don't like quarrels with our partners and wish they wouldn't happen, disagreement with one's lover is a normal part of human experience. It's impossible to live without it ever taking place. Yet Ray Rice experienced normal, regular conflict that exists in every relationship, family, and household in the world as so overwhelmingly unbearable and threatening that he hit his wife, knocking her unconscious, and dragged her limp body by the ankles out of the elevator, leaving her lying inert in a hallway. He looked at normal, everyday expression of difference, and he saw threat and responded with extreme cruelty. The Israeli government has kept the Palestinian Gaza Strip under siege since 2005. This has made daily life unbearable for its inhabitants. In the late spring of 2014, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu escalated pressure on the already suffering Palestinians, and some factions within Gaza responded with rockets that were of such poor quality they had only symbolic impact. The Israeli government re-reacted in turn to this response with over 50 days of aerial bombing and ground invasion, causing mass death and massive destruction of literal, cultural, and psychological infrastructure. The Gazans were resisting unbearable and unjustifiable treatment. The Israelis experienced this resistance as attack. From the most intimate relationship between two people to the power of the police to the crushing reality of occupation, these actors displayed distorted thinking in which justifiable behavior was understood as aggression. In this way, they overreacted at a level that produced tragedy, pain, and division. It is this moment of overreaction that I wish to examine. My thesis is that at many levels of human interaction, there is the opportunity to conflate discomfort with threat, to mistake internal anxiety for exterior danger, and in turn to escalate rather than resolve. I will show how this dynamic, whether between two individuals, between groups of people, between governments and civilians, or between nations, is a fundamental opportunity for either tragedy or peace. Conscious awareness of these political and emotional mechanisms gives us all a chance to face ourselves, to achieve recognition and understanding in order to avoid escalation towards unnecessary pain. Of course, it is not only the police, wealthy football players, or colonial occupiers who can feel abused in the absence of actual threat. It is not only the dominant who feel endangered when faced with normal conflict or when their own unjust actions are responded to with resistance. In fact, these distorted reactions occur in both the powerful and the weak, the supremacist and the traumatized, in society and in intimacy. In arenas in which real abuse could conceivably take place, there are those who feel persecuted and threatened even though they are not in danger, and they often lack help from those around them to differentiate between the possible and the actual. Bullies often conceptualize themselves as being under attack when they are the ones originating the pain. Everywhere we look, there is confusion between conflict and abuse. If a person cannot solve a conflict with a friend, how can they possibly contribute to larger efforts for peace? If we refuse to speak to a friend because we project our anxieties onto an email they wrote, how are we going to welcome refugees, immigrants, and the homeless into our communities? The values required for social repair are the same values required for personal repair. And so this discussion must begin in the most micro experience.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, author of the book Conflict is Not Abuse.
On a freezing snowy day in 2014, I was invited to a workshop run by social worker Catherine Hodes. A native New Yorker in her 50s, Hodes is an experienced professional with over 20 years of development and leadership in what was once known as the battered women's movement, but is now called intimate relationship abuse advocacy. Intimate abuse is a real crisis for New York. In 2014, the police received 284,000 intimate abuse calls in a year, which is about 800 a day, and made 46,000 intimate abuse arrests. Now, Hodes had boldly started to notice that clients were increasingly confused about what the word abuse actually means, that it was overused. The paradox is, of course, that many women are unable to recognize that they are being abused. And many women cannot get acknowledgement of this reality from others. Yet, at the very same time, Hodes also found that some women were applying the term abuse to situations that were really something else. Increasingly, she noticed that women who did not know how to resolve a problem sometimes described that feeling with the word abuse. So this session had been convened to address that trend directly with service providers. While identifying abuse is essential to saving lives and providing services, differentiating conflict from abuse is also essential to meeting clients' real need to learn how to face and deal with obstacles and to develop truthful assessments of themselves and others. And she asks people like, are you in danger or are you angry, upset, and frustrated? If you say I'm angry, upset, and frustrated, you're not going to be like, oh, well, go home. We're going to deal with the fact that you're angry, upset, and frustrated. But we just want to know, like, is that what's happening? Or are you actually in danger? So that there's validation. Another thing she suggests is looking at the order of events. And this is something that I've tried to use for my... I mean, she says when a client comes in, she asks them for the order of events. And almost immediately, she can tell whether it's abuse or conflict. So I started using order of events in my own problems. So I'll be like, well, first she did this to me, and then she did that, and then I, you know, whatever. And then she, so I guess that's the part about me, I like smush it, you know what I mean? Like, and like if your friends help you go through the order of events and they don't let you smush it, you can find out where you have escalated, where you've contributed to creating the conflict. Well, obviously, significant abuse takes place where one person is being controlled by another or by a group in a manner that the recipient has not contributed to and cannot change, but the word abuse has become overused. People may feel angry, frustrated, upset, but this does not mean they are being abused. They could instead be in conflict. Therefore, the fact that one person is truly suffering does not inherently mean that the other party is to blame. People may not know how to make things better, how to look at their own participation, how to deal with feeling badly about themselves. They may not know how to understand their own actions and are afraid of the implications of their actions on the meaning of their lives. And this may be devastating, tormenting, and painful, but this is not being abused. It does not get resolved by organizing the punishment of another person. People may be part of negative friendships, families, or communities who attack outsiders instead of being self-critical. They may be receiving encouragement to blame and scapegoat others. They may live within groups, relationships, or families that do not tolerate the admission of mistakes and that reinforce supremacy ideologies about each other in order to maintain illusions of righteousness. This pressure, resulting in the action of collectively deflecting blame, does not mean that the person being blamed is abusive. In fact, it says nothing at all about that person, except that they are being blamed. Okay. So what's interesting is as we were doing this workshop with Hodes, she started to explain to us that increasingly perpetrators have seized the apparatus, the state apparatus that was designed to protect victims. She said that perpetrators increasingly are the first ones to call the police, to threaten legal action, to send lawyer letters, or threaten or seek restraining orders as part and parcel of their agenda of blame and unilateral control. And the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs 2014 report on LGBTQI intimate partner abuse noted that the police misarrested the survivor as the perpetrator of violence in over half of all queer domestic abuse arrests, misidentifying the perpetrator in same-sex relationships as the one who is butch, of color, not a mother, not a citizen, from another culture, or HIV positive. One of Hodes's many valuable suggestions is to lower the bar for what must happen in a person's life for their suffering to be acknowledged. Quote, the current paradigm is encouraging all of us to think we are in abusive relationships, Hodes explained, and if you are not in an abusive relationship, you don't deserve help. Being abused is what makes you eligible, but everyone deserves help when they reach out for it. This is a strikingly humane idea, that the collapse of conflict and abuse is partly the result of a punitive standard in which people are made desperate, yet ineligible, for compassion. So, like in 1958, when I was born in New York City, if a woman was raped, she could only get a conviction if she had what? Does anybody know?
A witness.
She had to have a witness. So, at that period, the state was literally the enemy of women. And in the 1960s, when the feminist movement against male violence began, it was a movement that did not look for any kind of solution in the state. It had no expectations that the state would help women. In fact, there were very few women even in the state in terms of women lawyers and judges and this sort of thing. But also because that movement emerged at a time when globally there were a lot of revolutionary movements that were radically imagining transformations of our relationships to each other. There were post-colonial movements, gay liberation, women's liberation, black power, you know, radical movements with radical analyses. So when you look back at the 1960s feminist movement against male violence, you see that they attribute male violence against women and children to three things: patriarchy, poverty, and racism. So they saw it as structural. And their focus was not on punishing men. Their focus was on empowering women. So they did a lot of things that today we would call restorative justice, even though those words did not exist at that time. So, for example, abortion was illegal. They organized, you know, illegal abortion networks. They taught women self-defense classes. There were rape crisis hotlines. If you were raped, you could call a number, and a woman who had been raped would be on the other end. So these were solutions that were community-based. They did not involve the state. But the demand for these services was enormous, far more than a basic grassroots political movement could create. In the 1970s, the U.S. government started a program called CETA, where they would pay the salaries of people who ran these grassroots organizations. But in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, and that's like D-Day for all the problems that are going on in the states right now, right? So one of the first things he did, I think it was in the first 3 weeks of office, was he eliminated CETA, and a lot of these programs fell apart. What you start to see in the 80s is that the government starts to take on this role. So the government is saying, we are now going to be the people who are going to be in charge of violence. So we have programs that are all dependent on government funding. In order to work in the programs, you have to have government credentials. But even more dramatically, there's a huge crisis of meaning because the U.S. government is one of the greatest sources of violence in the world. So they cannot be the people in charge of ending violence. Also, the enforcers of their policies are the police. A police officer is the occupation with the highest rate of domestic violence of any occupation in the United States, including football player. So police officers do not know how to solve problems, and they're the last people you should be calling if you have a problem. So what we're seeing is this movement from this idea that communities should be helping each other address these conflicts to it being embedded in the state. And there was a lot of propaganda for this in popular culture. So the 80s is when you start to see things like Law and Order Special Victims Unit, right? So every week on TV, you're seeing an episode where there's a completely pure and innocent victim. And there's a totally evil predator. And the answer is the police. But the American police do not know how to solve conflict. We see stories in the U.S. press. A guy is having a fight with his son. He calls the police. The police come. They kill the son. Calling the police when we're actually in conflict instead of abuse. We do it to show that we are the pure victim and that we have no participation in escalating the conflict and we need the police. It's a performance of innocence because the way things are now is that the only way you get compassion from other people is if you're purely and completely innocent. But if we could allow a concept of our group relationships that allows people to be complex and to make mistakes and to show that they're contributing to escalating conflict without them being punished or shunned or humiliated, we would take back a lot of this power that we have as a community to try to address our own conflicts. Because what's going on right now, I think, is that the sign that we're being heard in our suffering is when the other person gets punished. These two things are completely linked, and they need to be separated. There needs to be a way that we can be heard, that we are authentically suffering and in pain, without the only proof of being heard being that somebody else is being hurt. You know, right now we define loyalty by meaning that we will join with the other people in our group to hurt the people who they say are their enemies or have been bad to them. That's how we define loyalty. And I'm amazed at how many times people ask me to hurt other people. They're like, why did you invite her? You shouldn't work with him. Don't go to that party, whatever it is. They're always telling you to isolate people, pretend they don't exist, pretend that people that we're sharing the earth with are not there. You know, and that's the definition of loyalty. And I'm saying that real loyalty and real love and real friendship is when you say, how can I help you negotiate? How can I be there for you so that you can take responsibility for your part in creating this conflict? You know, there's somebody who your clique had a falling out with like 5 years ago, and every time you see that person, you have a bad vibe with them, and then one day you realize you cannot remember what the incident was that you're still punishing this person for. At that point, just like say hi. You know, you see them, just say, hi, how are you? You don't have to get into a big thing, but just like, who do we think that we make ourselves by hurting other people forever without terms, shunning without terms? There have to be terms. Like if you stole my money to buy drugs, I have the right to say, hey man, you can't come into my house until you have 3 years sober. I think that that's fair, but those are terms. But for me to say, no matter who you become and no matter what you do in your life, I'm never going to treat you with respect again, that's absurd. It's about our self-image, that we have this idea that we are the good one, that we are the righteous one, because the other is the specter, they hold all the evil. There's a lot of different reasons that we're suffering, and sometimes it is a direct consequence of that person's actions, but sometimes it comes from our histories. I mean, I was born in 1958, which is 13 years after the end of the Holocaust, right? And I was raised with a concept of profound oppression, of Jewish oppression. And, you know, in 1944, 1945, Jews may have been the most oppressed people in the world. But in 1948, 3 little years later, when the Israeli state was founded, Zionists were able to seize control of the state apparatus and make another people, Palestinians, subordinate. So you have this going from extreme oppression, which has trauma that travels through generations. It doesn't suddenly end. And because of that history and that experience, people could not accept that they were now in an oppressor position. They could not emotionally accept who they really were in relationship to Palestinians and maintain this constant victim rhetoric. And you see the same thing with gay people. I mean, gay people who were profoundly oppressed, who lost their families, whose communities were decimated by AIDS because governments didn't care, who didn't have basic rights. And now we're in the homo nationalist period, where white gay people are invited into the state apparatus, joining the imperialist military, you know, this kind of white reconciliation between white gay people and white straight people to reinforce whiteness. And yet there's still kind of a rhetoric that comes from the past that doesn't acknowledge how that whiteness that they were maybe once excluded from on a certain level is now fully informed. So to be up to date on who you really are, you could have, and just it's the same thing's true for individuals. As children, we could have had terrible experiences of being completely defenseless and not being able to protect ourselves and being manipulated and violated. But as adults, we may have more autonomy than we actually understand that we have, because we're still living with the consequences of the past, having unresolved pain from the past, and trying to make the present accountable for something that the present has not created, which I guess is the famous trigger. The problem of how to turn these things around is really hard. I know that, like, this book, I know that I've gotten a lot of crazy accusations against me online. Like, there was somebody who wrote, Sarah Schulman is a known abuser. She punched her girlfriend in the face and broke her nose. This never happened, by the way. You know, and then somebody else writes, what do you mean? How do you know that? And they go, it's well known. And then, like, there it is, you know, or then it's on Tumblr and it's shared 1,000 times. And then everyone's like, she's an abuser. You know, I mean, yeah, there's two questions that come from this. Is one, how do you stop it? And the only way to stop it is third party intervention. When people who are not you call up that person and say, you know, why are you doing this? If you have evidence, let me see it. If you don't, you know, you're doing, this is really painful. And I don't want to be in a community where this is what's happening. We have to intervene. And this concept of third-party intervention comes from a book that I wrote called Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. It was the first analysis of homophobia in the family. And it's when I realized that the queer person is alone in there, in the family, and that our queer communities do not intervene with homophobic families. We privilege the family. And that we have to let that go. We have to have third-party intervention where we call the family and say, listen, you know, this is a beloved person in this community, and the way you're treating them is not right. And we don't, you know, we don't want you to treat them that way. You have to step up and defend people, because if you're defending yourself, it's not going to change. There's a thing going around saying that my book is telling people to call the police. Okay, obviously, it's not doing that. It's doing the opposite, right? They never read it. They never read it. And it's been shared like hundreds of times. And when I see it, I'll say, like, listen, do you want me to send you a copy of the book? Why don't you come to my, you know, discussion, or we can have a public discussion? They never come. You cannot have punishment without process, because this is how we all got stigmatized in the first place. Even if the process is painful, even if the process takes place in a group of friends, in a family, it doesn't have to be a state process. But just because someone is accused doesn't mean that they should be punished. I mean, it's really fun to watch these assholes get taken down. But, you know, who's firing them? The people who are firing them are just as bad as they are. And if a person really did do these things, what is appropriate punishment? You did X, you know, it could be rape, or it could be like asking someone to have sex with you. Right now, those are all the same. And if you do them, you lose your corporate job, and that's the punishment, and then it's over. But I'm not so sure that that's really the appropriate response either. You know, this kind of thing can trickle down, and it can get really messy, because pretty soon we're going to be saying, she broke her girlfriend's nose, you shouldn't let her read at your bookstore, and there's not going to be any kind of discussion.
Excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, whose book Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair, won the 2017 Judy Grahn Award for Lesbian Nonfiction. It's published in Vancouver, Canada, by Arsenal Pulp Press. Schulman was recorded by Robin Erickson. The talk was edited by Frieda Worden. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please visit facebook.com/wingsradio. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The Nature of Phenology is a weekly short feature focused on what's happening around us in nature each week. Learn about why red squirrels are so territorial, how woodpecker tongues serve as internal helmets to prevent concussions, what flowers are blooming and fish are running, and even learn some new bird songs. Join Hazel Stark and Joe Horn to learn about what you can observe outdoors every Saturday morning at 9:30 on WERU 89.9 FM or online at weru.org. You can also download past episodes of The Nature of Phenology by visiting archives.weru.org.